From NPR and WBEZ Chicago, this is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz. I'm Carl Castle, and here's your host at the Chase Bank Auditorium in downtown Chicago, Peter Sagal.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you, everybody. You are too kind. Thank you. Now, it is that time of year when we get together with our families and eat canned cranberry sauce and get drunk on endless bottles of two-buck chuck. And then we snipe and snap at our family members for long-ago slights that have been eating into our soul since childhood.
And that, Peter, is why I never invite you over.
Nonetheless, while we're all celebrating the holiday in whatever way we choose, we're going to do what we can to bring some happiness to your endless rehearsals of domestic grievances with some visits from our favorite guests recently.
We begin with the one man on earth who can claim to be cooler than I am. Actor, writer, and producer Henry Winkler, also known as Arthur Fonzarelli, from the classic sitcom Happy Days, also known as Fonzie.
Henry was as pleased to join us in September 2011, along with panelists Kerry O'Connor, Paula Poundstone, and Charlie Pierce, as we were to have him, or at least he was able to fake it.
I'm so happy to be here.
So thrilled to talk to you. So first of all, we were interested to see you have a new book out. It's about the least Fonzie-ish thing we can imagine, fly fishing in Montana.
That's right. It's called I Never Met an Idiot on the River.
Right. And what's interesting is that you had your wife of many years do the introduction. And
that was a mistake.
Yes, because she says, and I'll quote her, "Only in the serene beauty of fly fishing country does the crazed and competitive Henry Winkler appear." Is this true?
Well, the thing is that, you know, in a boat, you have, I'm in the front, and I have all the way to the guide and his oars. Yeah. My wife is in the back. She has all the way to the guide and his oars.
Right,
and
from the other end. Right.
Her water looks fishier than mine.
Right. So you're like, turn this thing around.
Well, no, I don't wait. I just start to fish her water.
And you do all this, and you do not keep the fish.
No, I always put the fish back. I won't even eat a trout in a restaurant.
Okay.
No.
And for someone like me, who does not fly fish,
yeah,
this seems astoundingly pointless. You go to all this effort.
You know what it is?
What?
It is, it's you, it's zen. It's like a washing machine for your brain, because you cannot concentrate on anything else except you and that fish, or you lose the fish.
Right. Do you think the fish wishes there was some other way you could find to relax? Now, your most famous role was Fonzie, the Fonz. Now, for people who were not lucky enough or old enough to have watched Happy Days, can you describe that character?
He was a mechanic.
Yeah.
He was a leather-jacketed, motorcycle-riding, loyal friend.
Yeah.
He was so tough that he intimidated you by just the look. He never actually raised his hand to anybody.
Yeah.
And I, as a very short Jew, that is the same experience.
I understand. Action stars talk about sometimes how people come up and challenge them to fights because they play tough men.
All right, here's the great thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, to this moment in time that we're talking, I have never been challenged. I have only been treated as a good friend.
Yeah.
My wife and I have been stopped on the street of New York City by gangs who said, "Oh, wait a minute, are you Henry Winkler? Give this man some room."
There you go. We got to ask you about this. We have to ask you, of course, about jumping the shark.
Yes.
Now, I actually don't remember the setup. This refers to an episode of Happy Days. Can you tell me what the setup was?
We went to Hollywood.
The characters did.
And I had to water ski, which I knew how to do, and my very short German parents would write me letters, and they would say, "Tell the producers you know how to water ski." I finally showed the producers the letter as a joke.
Because, wait a minute, your parents were, like, worried you were the star of the most successful sitcom on television, and they were like, "But maybe he can get a little more money if they know he can... Maybe he can make a success of himself if he can just water ski."
If I water ski, I will have it made in the shade.
Right. So then you show the producers the letter from your parents. "Hey, I can water ski," you point out to them.
Yes.
So they come up with a story in which Fonzie has to water ski over sharks?
Yes,
over a tank
I did.
Of sharks?
Well, I jumped over a shark. About that time, a guy named John Heim, who now has a radio show.
Yeah.
He was sitting in his dorm room with his good friend, and they came up with the expression, jump the shark.
Right, because they decided, and you know, that the moment when Happy Days started to go downhill was when Arthur Fonzarelli jumped the shark, and so jumping the shark became this universal phrase for the moment when something starts to go bad.
Yes.
How does it feel then to be the person who enacted the now the single most important cultural indicator of impending decline?
You know, I would like to say proud.
Yes.
But the fact is, I talked about this human being for 33 years, and I finally met him 3 months ago in New York City.
Really? And how did that meeting go? The guy who invented the phrase...
We had a wonderful time. It was really lovely to meet him.
I have to ask you a question, and we've only been talking for a little while, but I get the sense that you've never met anybody you weren't utterly delighted and happy to meet. Is that true? Is there
you know what? My glass is half full, but there are three or four people I really dislike.
Really? Can you name or describe any one of them?
Unfortunately, I can't. One's a movie star.
I understand.
You know, I met Henry, I think, on the shuttle at Dulles. You know how when you meet somebody and they're out of context and it takes your head a couple of ka-chings to figure out where you know them from. And what struck me about him was, I was like, well, look at that happy little fella.
You know, I'm doing the show from standing under my desk right now.
There you go. Well, Henry Winkler, we are absolutely delighted to talk to you, and we have, in fact, invited you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
Hey, you took all my money.
Wow, come on. Was that Castle?
That was. Uncanny, isn't it? Well, a Fonzie scheme would involve helping others through coolness and jumping sharks. A Ponzi scheme is something else entirely, as you may have heard about in the GOP debate this week. We're going to ask you three questions about Ponzi schemes. If you get two right, you'll win our prize from one of our listeners, Carl's voice, in their home answering machine. Carl, who is Henry Winkler playing for?
Oh, well, the Fonz is playing for Michelle Treastman of Arlington, Virginia.
Wow.
Yeah. You ready to do this?
I'm so ready, and I'm hoping.
All right. We'll start with Charles Ponzi,
the
original Ponzi schemester.
Right.
In 1920, he promised his investors a 50% return in just a few weeks, but some people were suspicious, so to prove he was in the up and up, he agreed to do what? A, appear with a mind reader who could discern his true intentions. B, buy everyone in Boston where he lived a lobster. Or C, bring each investor to his mother's grave so that he could swear on it.
Wow. I'm going to go with A.
You're going to go with what?
Oh, the first one.
No, I mean, say that again.
Oh, I have to go. I'm going to go with A.
A, all right. That's right, in fact. Ponzi agreed to appear with a mind reader at a Kiwanis club, but nothing came of it because audience members were far more interested in investing with him. He was in jail less than a week later. Next question. The Greater Ministries International Church of Florida ran a Ponzi scheme on its own congregants in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. Their get-rich-quick scheme was based on what? A, learning the trick of multiplying loaves and fishes from God. B, searching for lost Spanish treasure ships in Lake Okeechobee. Or C, investment-grade collectible Happy Meal toys.
I'm going to go with C.
You're going to go with C, investment-grade collectible Happy Meal toys. I'm afraid it was A, or A. The minister in charge of the scheme said God had modernized the loaves and fishes trick and taught him to apply it to the precious metals market. He made off with $500 million.
Wow.
All right, you have
one
more chance. If you get this one right, you win. And now, we'll turn to the greatest Ponzi schemer of all, Bernie Madoff.
Oh, yes.
He is now being held at a prison camp in Butner, North Carolina.
He's
serving, I think, a 150-year sentence.
Yes, not long enough.
Not long enough. The prison camp is actually pretty tough, but it does provide what for the use of its inmates? A, an Indian sweat lodge. B, a climbing wall, or C, a Bloomberg terminal for financial news?
Wow.
Yes. My advice here would be to trust your instincts.
Okay. Well, you know what?
If your instincts don't work, trust Fonzie's.
A sweat lodge.
Yes. A, an Indian sweat lodge. B, a climbing wall. Or C, a Bloomberg terminal for financial news.
Okay, now, oh my goodness. Okay, I'm going to go with A.
I'm sorry. What did you say?
I'm going to go with A.
Yeah, yes, you're right. It is A, an Indian sweat lodge. Carl, how did Henry Winkler do?
Hey, the Fonz had two correct answers, Peter. So he wins for Michelle Treistman.
Well done, sir. Well done. Henry Winkler's new book is called I've Never Met an Idiot on the River, Reminiscences and Photos of Fly Fishing. Henry Winkler, thank you so much for being with us. What a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Henry.
Bye, everybody.
Right now, thank you everybody, right now, even as you are all listening to this, we are walking around in a deep tryptophan-induced haze, picking at the turkey carcass, wondering why having three slices of pumpkin pie seemed like such a good idea at the time.
Well, I had five, and I'm proud of it.
So while we're lying around like pythons trying to digest our meal, here's something tasty for you. Jane Goodall went to the wilds of Africa when she was in her early 20s, and she went on to become the world's most famous expert on wild chimpanzees.
She joined us in September 2011, along with Paula Poundstone, Brian Babylon, and Jesse Klein.
Hello.
Wow. You got it. But can you tell me what that means in chimpanzee?
Well, it means hello. It's called Tantu, the distance greeting. You would hear it if you came with me to Gombe and climbed up the mountains and listened in the morning. And if you're lucky, you hear a chimpanzee greeting the day and basically saying, this is me. Who's out there? Who are you? And hello.
When you do it, I'm assuming you've done it with the chimpanzees. How do they look at you funny? Like, who is that very strange-looking chimpanzee?
I don't do it in the wild because we don't interact with them that way. But I sometimes do it, you know, with a captive group. And, of course, in each group, they have their own particular dialect. And I think when I greet the captive group this way, they're not quite sure what to make of it and who's talking and who is she.
Right. So one of the things that I did not know, I mean, I knew that you were a world-renowned primatologist, but I did not know that you began so early. You went to Africa to be with the chimpanzees at a very young age.
Well, I saved up and got to Africa. I mean, I had to save up. We didn't have any money. And I got there when I was 23 with no degree or anything and was fortunate enough to meet Louis Leakey, the famous anthropologist. And he offered me this opportunity to study chimpanzees. And I began in the field when I was 26.
How did you conceive that desire to go? I know a fair number of young women, but very few of them say that their real dream is to go to Africa and live with chimpanzees.
Well, it started when I was a tiny child, and, you know, then I found the books about Dr. Doolittle, who could speak animal language. And then when I was 11, I read the book about Tarzan, Lord of the Apes, Tarzan of the Jungle. And, of course, I fell passionately in love with this glorious being. And what did he do? He married that other stupid wimpy Jane.
You were jealous.
I was very jealous.
Now, you've observed so much about chimpanzees, and you've advanced our understanding so much. We were wondering if you or the chimpanzees through you have anything to teach us. For example, as you know, or maybe you don't know because you travel so much, here in America, the political situation has reached a complete impasse. So the question is, how do chimpanzees resolve disputes between groups, if they have a way?
Well, chimpanzees are very aggressively territorial.
Yes.
And if they see one or two individuals from a neighboring social group, they are liable to attack them very seriously. So like us, they have a dark side to their
really?
Nature.
Do they ever accuse each other of being socialists?
they might if they could speak. But actually,
do they ever send naked pictures of themselves to their constituents on Twitter? That's an insider.
That would be an interesting development.
It would be.
They are nicely covered with hair.
That's true. You give them, it's really funny, like a chimpanzee sexed you. It's like, I can't tell. It's just brown. What is that?
I got another brown sex.
Exactly. We understand that one of my favorite stories that we came across about you was about a Gary Larson cartoon some years ago.
Oh, yes. That was a lovely one.
Can you describe it?
Yes. It's two chimpanzees, and the female is grooming the male, and he's got his back to her. And she's holding up a hair, and she's saying, ah, another blonde hair, doing some more research, in quotes, with that Jane Goodall tramp.
We were told that your foundation saw it and was very angry with Mr. Larson, but you were not.
Well, I mean, this stupid woman who was the executive director at the time wrote and said, this implies that Jane Goodall has sexual relationships with the chimpanzees. I mean, honestly. That's an idea. No, I thought it was very funny, and I think if you make a Gary Larson cartoon, boy, you've made it.
That's true. It's absolutely true. Well, Jane Goodall, we are delighted and, in fact, honored to talk with you today, but we have also asked you here to play a game that this time we're calling...
He's Come So Far Since Valley Girl.
You study the lives and culture of the wild chimpanzee, but we thought we'd ask you about a creature that's truly wild. We're going to ask you three questions about the doings of actor Nicolas Cage. If you get two right, you'll win our prize. For one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their voicemail. Carl, who is renowned biologist Jane Goodall playing for?
Dr. Jane is playing for Candy Thompson of Augusta, Kansas.
All right, you ready to try this?
Okay.
Here we go. Mr. Cage, Nicolas Cage, says that once his own home was invaded by whom? A, the San Marino, California Con Air fan club. B, a very drunk Cher. Or see an otherwise naked man wearing a leather jacket and eating a fudgesicle.
Well, I'm going to pick the second one, whatever it was you said.
I said the actress and singer Cher.
Yeah, that's my choice.
Cher broke in. No, actually, although that I guess could happen, depending on the kind of day Cher had had, it was actually C, the mostly naked fudgesicle man.
Well, I just didn't like thinking about
that. No, neither did I. And neither did Mr. Cage. In fact, he disliked the experience so much that after he talked the man out of the house, he then moved. He says, all right, you have two more chances. There was speculation in the news just this week that actor Nicolas Cage is secretly what? A, an undead vampire. B, a woman. Or C, a really good actor.
Well, I'm going to pump for... a really good actor, because I'm getting a bit sorry for this Nicolas Cage.
We all are.
I'm going to say, personally, I think Nicolas Cage really is a good actor, so I don't think speculation that he would be a good actor would be in the news, personally.
Really?
I love National Treasure.
There you are. So anyway, back to you, Dr. Jane. Are you going to stick with that choice, or are you going to think about
it? No, I'm sticking with it.
You're sticking
all
with
right.
it?
Yep.
I have a feeling that I could not talk you out of this even if I tried, so I'll say no, I'm afraid it was undead vampire was the speculation.
Okay, because, all right. I knew it was going to be wrong, but I just thought I'd give him a plug.
I appreciate that. He appreciates that. Yeah. What happened was a Civil War era photo came to light showing a soldier from the Civil War who looks an awful lot like Nicolas Cage, and the guy who was trying to sell the picture on eBay insists that the only explanation for this is that Cage is an undead vampire who never ages. All right, you have one more question. Let's see if we can get this one. Cage got in some financial trouble recently, mainly because he spent a lot of money rather than sending it to the IRS, as he was supposed to. Among his extravagant purchases was what? A, a dirigible. B, a solid platinum golf putter. Or C, a Tyrannosaurus skull.
Oh, well, if I was Nicolas Cage, I'd definitely want the Tyrannosaurus skull. So.
You and he are of a like mind, because that was the answer, yes. Cage paid almost $300,000 for the skull. He beat out actor Leonardo DiCaprio at the auction. Cage also bought a castle in Germany, an estate in Newport, Rhode Island, and an entire island in the Bahamas.
Wow. Well, maybe Maybe after I've, you know, plumped for him as a really good actor, he'll make a donation to the Jane
Goodall. You know, after the win, you stood up for him. I have no doubt. Carl, how did Jane Goodall do in our show?
Well, she had one correct answer, Peter, but she needed two to win for Candy Thompson.
Ah, well.
I'm sorry for poor Candy. I apologize.
Frankly, I think that she'd rather just have the experience of you you playing for her than any actual prize. Jane Goodall, a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you for your work, and thank you so much for being here. Bye-bye. It's happened to us all. You go into a modern movie theater, you're enjoying the big cushy seats, the cup holders, and then as the movie begins, a creeping sense of horror comes over you as you realize, against all odds, that Jason Bateman is not in this movie.
It doesn't seem possible, but it is.
To make up for any time you might have inadvertently seen a movie this year without Jason Bateman in it, we invited him onto our show in August of 2011, along with Charlie Pierce, Amy Dickinson, and Mo Rocca.
Peter started by asking him if he ever worried about becoming an aging former child star.
You say worry, I say opportunity.
Really?
You're like, when you thin out the herd, opportunity abounds.
That's true. Do you ever, I mean, you have this odd experience of having your childhood on film. Do you ever go back and look at yourself?
Only if I want to cry in my bowl of cereal looking at hairdos and clothes.
Right. You were also on one of my favorite TV shows, Valerie, that then became the Hogan Family.
It was one of those rare shows that actually had four names. It started as Valerie, then Valerie's Family, then Valerie Harper, I guess, had some sort of disagreement with the powers that be. They elected to remove her from the show.
They killed her off.
An episode where she burned a horrible death in a house fire. And then they called the show The Hogans and then The Hogan Family.
Well, that, I mean, I never actually watched it. It was my favorite show for that reason. It was so existentially frightening.
Yeah.
Like, you could be the star of your own show. Your name could be in the title. And the next day, you burn in a horrible accident off screen.
Yeah, I can't wait to see what they're going to do with Charlie Sheen.
Yeah. So we were thinking about your recent career in that starting with Arrested Development, you seem to have kind of a lock on the normal, sensible guy in the middle of the madness. Would you think that's accurate?
Well, a lock, I'm not sure, until the next one comes along. But it was definitely my job on that show to sort of react to all of the absurdity. And I really, really enjoyed doing that because I'm a big fan of comedy, and you need that component. Otherwise, you basically have Martians on Mars, and there's nothing that interesting about that. You need to somehow make it relatable.
Right.
Change Up actually is a movie where I organically get to play the opposite of the character that you would normally hire me to play, which is how I start the film,
right.
The real normal guy, and then when we pee in a magic fountain, you switch lives. I mean, that's what happens.
Is that what happens when you pee in a magic fountain?
Yeah, don't do it.
Oh, okay. By the way, were we hearing your daughter in the background?
It was. I'm doing this call in her bedroom, and she just came in and gave me a look like, what the hell are you doing in my room?
Are you sitting under like a canopy bed kind of thing?
on
your stomach?
There is no canopy, but I am now wearing a hand sock puppet made out of some awful sports sock from her school. I don't know what kid she took this off of, but I don't even want to risk smelling it.
I understand. And how old is your daughter?
She'll be 5 in October.
Oh, wow. So I'm just imagining you sitting there talking to us, hugging her My Little Pony pillow. Is that?
No, I'm not. Well, I'm not hugging her pillow. I'm not hugging her either. I put my boot in her ass and told her to get the hell out.
Absolutely. Daddy's doing an interview.
Yeah.
Why do you need to use your daughter's bedroom?
Because she'd already invaded my office because she likes to play games on my computer.
Right.
My wife is talking to anyone who will listen on her phone in the kitchen, and the TV's on in the den, and the only quiet place is Franny's little bedroom until she walked in here and started pissing me off.
What did you do with all the stuffed animals that are arranged on her bed, I'm guessing?
Oh, those stuffed animals are keeping me nice and comfortable.
Absolutely. Well, Jason Bateman, we're delighted to have you. We've invited you here to play a game we're calling...
What's that, Cheetah? You sense danger?
So, you were a famous child actor, so we're going to ask you about the one thing even cuter than child actors, animal actors. There's no more famous animal actor than Cheetah, the chimpanzee who played opposite Johnny Weissmuller in all those Tarzan movies. Answer three questions about Cheetah, and you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice in the home answering machine. So, Carl, who is Jason Bateman playing for?
Jason is playing for Lenny Sapoznikov of Brooklyn, New York.
All right, first question. Cheetah is the holder of the Guinness World Record as the oldest chimp in captivity. He's been in retirement for many years, doing what? A, watching TV and doing abstract paintings at his home in Palm Springs, California. B, working as Chiquita Bananas' global banana-loving ambassador. Or C, just living quietly with a retired lassie.
Well, I think he is definitely out there in Palm Springs painting away and sunning and sunning and sunning, because his hair's all got to be gone by now. He's got to sun that skin.
You're right, actually. I don't know about the hair, but Cheetah is, in fact, living in Palm Springs, where he likes to paint, looks at National Geographic, watches TV. Mm. Second question, for his 75th birthday in 2007, it was a huge to-do, and it included what special honor? A, the state of California declared Cheetah the official state non-human primate. B, great ape expert Jane Goodall sang him happy birthday in chimpanzee language. Or C, actor Clint Eastwood sent over a cake with the words, to a better actor than me.
I've got to go with C.
You're going to go with Clint. Being modest in his Clinty way. No, actually, it was B. Ms. Goodall was at the party for Cheetah and attempted to sing happy birthday with the chimpanzee hoots she had learned in Africa.
Wow.
Yeah, okay.
So you gave me a stumper.
I did. But here's the last one. Here's you get this one right, you still win. Last question. Just a year later after that, in 2008, an enterprising reporter made a shocking discovery. What was it? A, the cheetah wasn't a chimpanzee at all, but a gorilla with mange. B, that Cheetah and Tarzan hated each other and constantly fought during the filming for the affections of Jane. Or C, that the cheetah living in Palm Springs was really only about 40 years old, had never been in a Tarzan movie, and was generally a complete fraud.
Oh, my gosh.
I have to go with C.
Yes, see, you're going to go for C, that the cheetah is in fact a fraud. You're right.
Oh,
that's true.
Is.
Although Cheetah has been living in Palm Springs, celebrated, had a big birthday party as Guinness Book of World Records, none of that is true. It turns out he was born in the 1960s and has never been in a movie in his chimpanzee life.
Monkeys really, are notorious liars.
It's true. Carl, how did Jason Bateman do in our quiz?
Jason had two correct answers, Peter. That's good enough to win for Lenny Sapoznikov.
Well done. Whoa. Jason Bateman's new movie, The Change Up, opens this weekend. Jason Bateman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
All right.
Thanks,
talk
Jason.
To you soon.
Bye, Jason.
Bye. Bye-bye.
I'm a monkey's uncle, a cousin to a chimpanzee.
Our show's almost done, which this weekend means it's almost time to eat again, but we've got a couple more visits with interesting people to share with you. First up, one of my favorite guests of the past year. She's a fashion blogger, a writer, and the editor of the most interesting new magazine for teenagers since the advent of Boy's Life. She's also 15 years old.
Tavi Gebinson had to have her parents drive her to our theater when she joined us in October 2011, along with panelists Faith Saley, Tom Baudet, and Maz Jobrani. Tavi started by telling us what her life was like as a suburban high schooler by day, international fashionista by night.
It is like Hannah Montana.
It is. I've noticed, I don't know much about fashion, but I looked at your blog. You tend to like vintage stuff.
Yeah.
I'm told that you have a big obsession with the 90s in particular.
You know, I like a lot of stuff from the 90s, but... I was
there. It wasn't that much fun. What? like what? What do you like from the 90s?
I like My So-Called Life and the Riot Girl movement and Freaks and Geeks.
Sure.
Which went into 2000, but yeah.
I know. It still counts. End of the 90s. So the culture of the 90s is exciting to you?
Yes.
You have this taste that you've expressed that people are start paying attention to you, flying you around, as we've said. Do you begin to feel that you have some influence? Do you like, wow, I could feature this dress or this designer of this pair of shoes or this whatever on my blog and it will get a big jump in the world. Should I? Shouldn't I? Are you beginning to get crazed with power, I guess is my question?
No, I have not taken advantage of that. I should.
Right. Well, people... Listen. Stick with me. You'll go far. This is a personal question. Because I happen to know some teenage girls. They live in my house. And if I wanted to talk to them... I haven't yet... I'm a little scared. But if I wanted to talk to my teenage daughters, can you tell me some common mistakes that I should avoid, for example?
I don't know. I'm not like a parent spy, but like,
so what,
I guess...
What annoys you? You're an articulate young woman, so what really bothers you?
Well, this isn't just parents, but like blaming everything on like PMS.
Okay.
Sorry,
Important tip.
Yeah, because, you know, it doesn't seem to kind of, like, dismiss emotions based on, like, an assumption.
You could be angry for other reasons.
Yeah, and legitimate reasons.
I didn't know that.
All right, let me try it the other way. If there's something I wanted to say to my teenage daughters to make them think I'm cool, I know this is a lot to ask, but in general, what sort of name should I drop or comment should I make?
You should just speak in, like, abreeves. And
abreeves?
Yeah.
Like, all right, already I'm at sea, so what is an abreeve?
An abreeve is an abreeve.
It's an abbreviation. So give me an example. So a brief is like abbreviate. So give me an example.
Like, your totes gel of that boy, yo.
Oh man.
This is how I talk to my peers.
Okay, so I should go up to my 13-year-old daughter and I should say, to your totes gel of that boy, yo.
Yes. And,
I need a subtitle.
If I were to say this, and you should tell me this now before I try it, if I were to say this to my daughter, what would I be saying?
You should just say it and go and improvise.
Really? Just see what happens.
Yeah. My goal is to sabotage the Segal family.
And be like, but no, Tavi Gevinson, she knows Anna Wintour, don't hit me again. Is it your PMS? No, I didn't mean that, I'm sorry. Well, Tavi Gevinson, we are just delighted to have you here with us and to spend some time with you. And then frankly, I'd talk to you all day, but rules are rules and we have to play a game. And today the game is called...
Frankly, I really miss Murder, She Wrote.
You're an expert on the things people of your generation love, fashion, pop music, irony. But what do you know about what old people like? We're going to ask you three questions about the tastes of the elderly, and if you get two right, you'll win our prize for one of our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine, which is something that elderly people still have, just so you know. Carl, who is Tavi Gevinson playing for?
Tavi is playing for Anne Lamoureux of Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
All right. Tavi, here's your first question. You ready to do this?
Yes.
All right. Now, old people are very fond of a TV show called Law and Order, which recently went off the air after 20 years, and one of the most famous elements of that show was a specific sound. It's called the Law and Order clang. Here it is. That just those two beats were created by composer Mike Post. He says he combined 6 or 7 different sounds just to get that effect. Among the things that you're hearing in that is what? A single shirtless man jumping out of a vinyl chair. B, 500 Japanese men stamping their feet on a wooden floor, or C, Walter Cronkite clearing his throat?
The 500 dudes.
The 500 Japanese guys jumping on the floor? You're right! Yes!
Whoa. Nice!
Wow!
Actually, listen to it. According to my post, that's what you're hearing. Very good. Next question. Another thing that older people like is the music of Neil Diamond. Something most people don't know about the famous singer-songwriter is that he is also what? A, an expert swordsman, B, a devout Hindu, or C, an avid builder of elaborate Lego displays?
Hindu?
Hindu, you think?
Yeah.
No, actually, it's swordsman.
Oh,
he's an expert fencer. He fenced for New York University. And to this day, he sometimes warms up for concerts with a little blade work. All right, this is exciting, though, because you have one more chance. If you get this, you win. Here we go. Or win for a listener. Sometimes, old people will drive around in their Buick Regals listening to something else they like, NPR. Which of these was the title of a real NPR program? A, period, comma, exclamation point. B, I'd rather eat pants. Or C, the joy of flutes.
The pants one?
The pants one, I'd rather eat pants?
Yes.
You're right! Yes! Whoa! However did you know?
I don't. I'm a genius.
Yes, well, I'd Rather Eat Pants was a, quote, hilarious, unquote, original radio play broadcast by NPR during Christmas 2002. It starred Ed Asner and Ann Mira. It was about old people. Carl, how did Tavi Gevinson do in our quiz?
Well, Peter, Tavi had two correct answers, and that's enough to win for Ann Lamoureux.
Thank you. Well done.
Thank you very much.
Tavi Gevinson is a young woman behind Rookie Magazine online at rookiemag.com. Tavi Gevinson, what a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much. Tavi Gevinson, ladies and gentlemen. Here's one more very cool daughter, although she's a little bit older. Roseanne Cash grew up touring with her father, Johnny Cash, before becoming an acclaimed musician in her own right.
And when she joined us, along with Kerry O'Connor, Roy Blunt Jr., and Luke Burbank in July of 2011, she talked about what it was like to be on the road with the man in black.
He was really funny in that way. He liked getting to a new hotel and seeing if there was chocolate. He said he just loved to know what the amenities were in the next hotel. And he made it fun on the road. It was a great time.
That's a positive attitude.
It is a positive
I had no idea I had so much in common with Johnny Cash.
I can just see Johnny Cash coming in and checking out the shampoo.
Yeah.
Look at that's a separate shampoo and conditioner.
He had a very childlike spirit in all things.
Well, there's a connection, of course, to your father in your latest album, The List,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty great. And this relates to a moment you had with your father, right?
Yeah, when I went on that tour you were just mentioning, he sat in the back of the tour bus and spent the afternoon making this list for me of what he called 100 essential country songs. And I had the good sense to hold on to that list. I didn't really think about it. I just kept moving it around wherever I went in a box of letters. And then, you know, when he passed away, I started thinking about it. And that same way, like your mother leaves you a recipe and you don't care about it until she's gone.
Yeah. Did you understand what he meant by this?
Oh, yes.
Wow.
I wanted that information.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I knew he was giving me himself, not just the list, but saying this is my deepest soul right here.
Right. And did your father ever work with you when you were starting to write songs? Did you ever, like, show him your songs and get his input? Because that would be totally intimidating to me.
Well, but it was just a in a parental way. He would say everything I did was great, like any good parent does. And it was terrible.
Oh, wait a minute. Are we supposed to do that? Hang
well,
on. I got to make a phone call. So your book, you're out with a new book, a memoir called Compose.
Yes.
And now you're an author on tour promoting your book. How does that compare with being a musician on tour? How do authors trash their hotel rooms?
Well, you know, the dressing rooms are a lot cleaner for authors.
Really?
Yeah. You know, no sound check, no filthy dressing room, no cranky musicians, no feedback. It's kind of nice. It's a civilized world.
Really? But how are the groupies?
The same.
Really? Because I'm gonna. Do you have groupies? Because we've had female singer-songwriters in the show before, Nico Case, for example, and they have denied that successful, talented singer-songwriters like yourself have groupies.
Yeah, she's not telling the truth.
She's not? All right, set us straight right now. You've had the male equivalent of the sweet young thing waiting for you backstage?
Oh, sure. And also, I'm Nico's groupie, so, you know. It's
yeah, I know. Well, we all are in a way. But yeah. So seriously, the like guys out there batting their eyes and...
Well,
I don't know.
Do I need to tell you that, Peter? You know, take a leap.
I tell you what, I'll just make suggestions and you just giggle if it's true.
How about I nod?
Yeah, but if you nod, that'd be great. That's very good. So, Roseanne, I know you have kids of your own and that some of them are grown, and some of them at least have gone into music too, right?
One, my middle daughter is a musician, Chelsea Crowell. She just released her first record.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Yeah.
That's pretty exciting. And did she come to you and talk to you in the way that you went to your father?
No, she doesn't want to know anything. She's just like I was. The only thing she's ever asked me was a really technical thing about a tuning.
Really?
That's it.
Are you ever insulted? Are you like,
no,
oh, here.
Actually, no, you know, she did say, Mom, how can I become successful without getting famous? Which is exactly the question I asked.
Really? You asked your father, and what was the answer he gave you?
He said, I'm the wrong person to ask.
What did you say to your daughter?
I'm the wrong person to ask. You know, how can she be herself? She's got the weight of two generations in back of her.
That's true.
Of songwriters. She's got to do it. I totally understand.
Did you make a list like your father did?
She asked for it. That's the one thing she did ask
for. Oh. What'd you write
down? She said email doesn't count.
Oh. So you had to write it down.
I have to write it down.
And have you done it yet?
I've started it. I take that very seriously.
Can you tell me what is on it?
I'm not going to tell you my list before I tell my own daughter. I mean, Peter, I really like you. But,
Anyway, no, we are delighted to have you with us. We've asked you here, Roseanne Cash, to play a game we're calling...
Man, you sing a lot better now than you did at that Padres game.
Carl is expressing surprise because obviously he's confused you with another Roseanne.
Oh, my God.
Roseanne Barr, of course. She famously butchered the national anthem at a Padres baseball game. So inspired by his mistake, we're going to ask you three questions about the other Roseanne, Roseanne Barr. Get two right, you'll win our prize for our listeners, Carl's voice on their home answering machine or voicemail. Carl, who is Roseanne Cash playing for?
Roseanne is playing for Leslie Hornig of Chicago.
All right. Ready to
May
play,
May I Roseanne? Apologize to Leslie in advance?
That's a tactic often used around here to little avail. Here we go. First question. Roseanne's image was pretty much set when she divorced her husband to marry Tom Arnold. And at their wedding, Tom made what announcement to the media? Was it A, we're just hoping to live a quiet life and devote ourselves to good works? B, I think this marriage is going to last at least a couple of years. Or C, we're America's worst nightmare, white trash with money.
I think he said, we're your worst nightmare.
That's what he said. He said, we're America's worst nightmare, white trash with money. And lo, so it came to pass. next question. Roseanne did divorce Mr. Arnold in a few years, as she did a number of husbands, but all is well now. In fact, one of her ex-husbands now does what for a living? A, he works along with his new wife as Roseanne's personal assistant. B, he's the manager of a pub called the Roseanne Bar. Or C, he is married in Las Vegas to a Roseanne Bar impersonator.
What? I didn't even get that last one.
Well, he was so fond of his ex-wife, he decided to marry the next best thing, a professional Roseanne Barr impersonator.
That's kind of disgusting.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. He has the Roseanne Barr?
I'm sorry, is that your guess, that he owns the Roseanne Barr? No, yes. I'm afraid not. He actually works with his wife as Roseanne's personal assistant.
Oh, I should have known that.
Why in the world should you have known that? You have lived your life in a far more useful and productive way than to know anything about that, I just want to say. All right. Here's your last question. If you get this right, you still win. 11 years after her top-rated sitcom Roseanne went off the air, Roseanne Barr is making a triumphant return to television this summer in what vehicle? A, My Daughter Roseanne, in which she plays a 12-year-old with a rare disease that makes her look like she's 57 and Roseanne Barr. B, Roseanne's Nuts, a reality show about her macadamia nut farm in Hawaii. Or C, Roseanne's Idol, in which Roseanne teaches amateur singers her particular methods.
I know the answer to this because Sandra Bernhardt is my very good friend.
Yes.
And she just did the macadamia nuts show.
Really?
That's my answer, yes.
Wow, so you're choosing based on actually knowing it's true. Which is a very rare tactic on this quiz, but you're choosing Roseanne's Nuts?
Yes.
Yes, you're right. It's on Lifetime. You can enjoy it. There it is.
Oh, my God, Peter, I was more nervous about this quiz than about opening at Lincoln Center, I swear.
Really? Carl, how did Roseanne Cash do in our quiz?
Roseanne Cash had two correct answers, Peter, so she wins for Leslie Hardig.
Yay! Yeah.
Roseanne Cash is an award-winning singer-songwriter and the author of the memoir Composed. It's out in paperback this week. Roseanne Cash, what a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks.
And thank you for the great record.
Now I've got
That's it for our Thanksgiving show.
Just think, in the time you've listened to this, you've burned enough calories to fit in one more teaspoon of gravy.
Support for NPR comes from Pimsleur Language Programs, offering tools to say Cyber Monday in more than 45 languages with 30-minute daily lessons at Pimsleur.com. Lumber Liquidators, providing hardwood flooring for the home handyman and professionals. Catalogs are available, 1-800-HARDWOOD. And CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is a production of NPR and WBEZ Chicago in association with Urgent Haircut Productions. Doug Berman, benevolent overlord. BJ Lederman composed our theme. Our program is produced by Ian Chillog, Eva Waltrover, and Emily Ecton. Our technical directors are Robert Newhouse and Lorna White. The executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is Michael Danforth. Thanks to Carl Castle, thanks to all of our panelists, and thanks to all of you for listening. I am Peter Sagal. We will see you next week. This is NPR.